You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Stephen Sanchez. He's talking to me from Fresno, California. Stephen, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks for having me on.
Stephen, let's talk about what you're working on now. I know you're writing a number of different things, but what are you working on, and what's in your field of activity at the moment?
So right now I'm working on my next book of poems. My previous book of poems, Phantom Time, kind of addressed the intersections of internalized racism and internalized homophobia and how those kind of impact bodies of color. And my new collection that I'm working on is sort of taking a different approach to that. It's addressing how all of us are somehow complicit in systemic oppression, and it's attempting to unpack, like, how do we acknowledge the ways that our privilege is harming others, whether we mean to or not. And, those are where my poems are kind of headed right now at the moment.
Okay, let's talk more about that. You just said systemic repression. Was that what you used?
Systemic oppression, yes.
Systemic oppression. And in the previous poems, in Phantom Tongue, you were talking about internalized racism and homophobia?
Correct.
So let's talk about that a little bit, because that's a kind of complex thing to discuss, I think. What do you mean by internalized racism and homophobia? Or maybe you can give me an example, but I just like to talk about that subject. How would you describe that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, like, growing up, like, I'm queer and Latino, in case anyone didn't know. but growing up, if someone had asked me if I wanted to be white or straight, I would have totally said yes. Like, flip that switch, make me those two things. And I didn't realize until I was much older, like starting grad school, that the reason I felt that way was because, like, larger society kind of promotes, or erases, I should say, Latinx voices and queer voices, and kind of makes it seem like those aren't valuable. Looking at any sort of mainstream representations of where queer folk are, Latinx folk are, you don't really see a lot, especially existing at those intersections. And so what ends up happening, and actually psychologists have done some research on this as well, is particularly with queer youth, there's a few phases that most queer youth go through. There's like rejection of who they are. Then there's sort of like, after that rejection, then they start coming to like realizing, oh, hey, like no matter how much I ignore this, I'm going to be this way. And then from that point on, either they isolate themselves or they begin to hate themselves, or sometimes both. And then after that point, either they can get to a point of acceptance or like, yeah, I'm excited that I'm queer, or they might never reach that point and like remain in that sort of self-isolation, self-loathing state. And I didn't realize that that was such a common phenomenon among queer youth. And so a lot of my poems are kind of addressing at least what my experiences were like with that, how I could be queer but also hate queerness. Not that I do anymore, but just sort of like when I was growing up, I felt that way. And the same sort of thing happened with like my Latino-ness. Growing up, my mom was fluent in Spanish. My grandma was fluent in Spanish. And when my mom was in school, she actually faced a lot of racism for speaking Spanish, having a slight accent. And so when I was born, she basically like said she was only going to teach me English and she wasn't going to teach me Spanish because she wanted to kind of protect me from the sort of racism that she experienced. But I think that had an unintended consequence of making me see English as like somehow better than Spanish, and by extension, seeing like white culture as like better than like Mexican culture. And so what ended up happening is growing up, like when I have friends, my mom's like, oh, wow, you have so many like good friends. And it was kind of coded for like white friends. And so then I started like assisting that at a really young age. Like, oh, like the closer I can assimilate and approximate whiteness, like the better I'll be. And I didn't realize that was like also really problematic until later on in life. And so what my first book kind of does is sort of interrogates like, how is it that the way that we control language and the way that we erase our uses of language can cause marginalized folks to feel like they don't appreciate or respect or want those parts of themselves. And that not only like how harmful it is to that person, but also how that person may end up harming others because of it.
That's fascinating and such a tough subject in a way to unpack. So when you talked about the like the psychological construct of what psychologists say you go through, one of those phases wasn't a self-realization of internalized racism and homophobia. It sounds like in most cases there's still a feeling of isolation that, and just correct me if I'm wrong, but as you went through those steps, one of those steps wasn't where either you are now or where your poems are kind of headed or kind of talking about, which is this idea that that the racism and homophobia that queer people feel is internalized. That may never be a realization, right? Or may never be the final stage, is what it sounded like from what you were just saying.
Yeah, no, like, and I think that's what terrifies me most is, like, a lot of folks might not realize that that's what's going on because they don't get the language to articulate that. Like, I think the analogy I like to use the most is sort of, like, I see it as, like, a terminal sort of thing. Like, the culture we live in is homophobic, is sexist, is racist, is ableist, is transphobic, is all these things. And, like, when we're building up our identities, like, especially as kids growing up in this culture, we can't help but build our identities around those dangerous narratives. And once we start internalizing those narratives, we start, like, adding more layers of who we are. Like, oh, like, I like rock music, or, oh, I want to be, like, a writer. Oh, I want to do this or that. And so it becomes, like, the core of who we are, and it requires constant interrogation. And so sort of like the way cancer spreads and it can appear in the body, it can disappear, absolutely, but it can also reappear because it's terminal. You just have to constantly monitor it. And I think the trick with internalized racism and internalized homophobia, along with other internalized oppressions, is to realize that no matter what we do, we're not going to eradicate that from ourselves. We have to constantly monitor it and be aware of how it can sneak in. The way we're thinking, the way we're talking, the way we're behaving. It's a lot of work, but also really important work to be done.
Absolutely. Well, and that's so interesting. It's and that's a lot to monitor, how we think, talk, behave, because, of course, we're reading books, we're watching movies, we're watching television, and maybe lately some things are changing, but probably everything we grew up on and admired and aspired to encourages just the kind of internal racism and homophobia you're talking about, that it's not easy to find models or even stepping stones to get out of that, it sounds like, because if I'm correct in understanding, your coming out of that or recognition of that wasn't until graduate school, right?
Correct.
So for you, was it the education in graduate school? What was the thing that made you think, wow, I mean, or had that kind of awakening?
Yeah, and honestly, it wasn't even necessarily the education part of it, but it was like my friends that I made in graduate school, who are also people of color, and some of them queer as well, kind of like pointing out, hey, by the way, like, let's have a discussion about what you're like thinking right now or what you're saying right now, because this is important. And it took a little bit of time for me to realize what exactly was happening, because I think we have such stigmas around the words racism and homophobia, which rightfully so, like, those are horrible things. But I think as a culture, we have this tendency of labeling individuals as racist and homophobic, which individuals absolutely can be. But that kind of erases the fact that racism and homophobia are also, like, embedded in our cultural ideology, and certain ideologies that we attach to end up perpetuating racism and homophobia. So it's not necessarily that we're a bad person if we accidentally slip into that. It's that we need to just be more conscious and aware of it. And it took me a second to realize that, and I think it takes a lot of people a long time to realize that, if they ever realize that at all.
And the current book or the current series of poems, that, I mean, because what we're talking about is internalized racism and internalized homophobia, and that's what was addressed in Phantom Tongue from 2018.
Correct.
And what you're working on now is poems that are dealing with systemic oppression. Is that correct?
Yeah. So
yeah, how does that differ from internalized racism and homophobia? That sounds so close, really, but I'm sure it's not. How is that different?
Oh yeah, no, they're like super close still, I think, because I think in Phantom Tongue, what I was kind of trying to investigate was how does a person internalize those things? And now what I'm trying to investigate, my next collection is, okay, so you're not going to escape these things, but even if you're aware of them and trying to interrogate them, like, how have you or how can you possibly harm others with those mentalities? There's, like, for instance, a few months ago, actually, I was playing Pokemon Go at Woodward Park here in Fresno, and there was a young woman jogging on the path. It was kind of late at night, like maybe 7:30 or 8, and I was just, like, catching Pokemon. And as I look up, like, I see her, and, like, I smile, like, oh, like, I'll smile, and I'll say hi. And she looks at me, and then she, like, runs across to the other side of the path just to avoid me. And then I click, like, oh, shoot, like, here I am, like, it's the middle of the night. I'm a man that she doesn't know, and obviously we know that violence against women, like, is a really serious issue, and so she's, like, defense mode. I got to make sure I avoid this contact in case, like, he's dangerous. And at that point in time, it's not like I was intentionally trying to harm her or do anything bad, but I also had the privilege of not having to think about the gender dynamics of that because I was the person with more social power. So one of my poems are kind of trying to unpack moments like that where there's everyday things that we can be more conscious of that would like possibly change dynamics around us. But there's also other threads I'm thinking about too. Like my younger brother, he was, he's also queer. And I was not the greatest of brothers when I was like growing up, because of my internalized homophobia. And so I'm also trying to address now how the way that I might've bullied him or harmed him, affected him then and possibly affected him now. And my own relationship to that and what different ways I have of imagining like a different outcome.
A different outcome, meaning how it's possible to have treated your brother differently or how we could treat all our, I mean, in the larger sense of the world, brethren, sisters, differently, and how there would be a different outcome because your sense of, or the systemic oppression that's kind of working on you is then working through you to your brother. Is that what you mean? Like how that could have, how your language could have been different, how your behavior could have been different?
Exactly. Because, I mean, that's exactly how systemic oppression works, because it works through us. And so I'm hoping that if I can, like, instead of talking about how we internalize it, I want to start talking about how that process works through us and how it impacts others. So sort of give maybe tangible ways of addressing it.
And so, you know, the poems that you're writing are, it sounds like they're also really not just, not that a poem can't just be for itself, right? A poem is, but they're also, in a sense, a call to action or a sense of awareness and even a kind of instructions for how to manage that or how would you frame them within the context of what we're talking about? Because poetry is such an unusual form as opposed to fiction, as opposed to, you know, a lecture or something or other activist platform. But it is a platform nonetheless that can do all those things that other forms can do, like potentially awaken the listener, the reader to a new world. Is that part of your goal to awaken them or teach or just explore the way you did in graduate school and still are?
Like when I first started writing poems, I was so afraid of being labeled a quote unquote political poet, because I didn't want to be like pigeonholed in that category. But then I realized like the reason I write and the reason I like want to express the things that I'm thinking about is because I do actually want change to happen. And while I don't know if my poems will necessarily cause that change, I think about a quote from Adrienne Rich where she talks about how there's two kinds of political poems. She says there's a good political poem and a bad political poem. And she says a bad political poem creates an argument and the good political poem creates an experience for the reader. And through that experience, a transformation might possibly happen. And so when I'm approaching my poems, I want to create that experience for a reader. Because, like, I don't know if any, like, most people probably don't like being preached at or lectured at or, like, told, here's what you need to do, now do it. But I think a lot of people, when given the opportunity to, like, share in an experience, might have at least a semblance of an understanding of what that person might be talking about, and hopefully it'll slightly shift the way that they're viewing things. And on that note, one of my mentors in grad school, Connie Hennis, had a really great analogy, too, for poetry and its relationship to social justice. And it's sort of, she's an analogy of, like, rivers. Like, you have, like, a mainstream, right? Like, it has the full force of it. It's been going for years like that, and, like, people are just sort of like, oh, okay, the river's there. That's the river. But then you have these smaller tertiary streams that sort of feed into it. And the tertiary streams kind of get erased and caught up in that river. But eventually, over time, if enough tertiary streams start entering the mainstream, it can change that mainstream to follow a completely different direction, which happens, like, naturally in the world. And so she said that she kind of looks at poems as, like, little tertiary streams that, yeah, on their own, they may not change the mainstream, but if enough people start addressing those subjects, addressing those issues, there can be enough force to actually change the flow of that mainstream. And so I guess, in a nutshell, like, that's what I want my poems to be able to do. I don't know if they'll ever change of the mainstream, but I want them to be just one more tertiary stream in an attempt to change that direction.
Yeah, that makes sense, and that's clear. And I think that would be the goal, would you say, of something like Citizen, an American Lyric by Claudia Rankine. That's would that be sympathetic to what you're saying, that her goals were similar?
Yeah, I think so, absolutely.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So tell me a little bit about when, how to talk about Phantom Tongue a little bit, which was also winner of the Rochelle Ratner Memorial Award. It seemed to get a lot of attention. I would think nowadays it's not easy, or it ever was, to publish poems. You know, I mean, books are difficult enough to publish, but poems, I would think more so. Is that the case, do you think? And also, how did that one come to be published?
I think publishing is a really complicated game. it took me a while to start publishing poems, and I think that's because it took me a while to, like, feel comfortable writing the poems that I felt I needed to write, instead of trying to write poems that, like, other people were expecting me to write. And once I stopped caring about what other people were thinking, I started writing the poems that are important to me. And once that happened, I started looking for, like, journals and presses that also seemed to be publishing work that spoke to the same sort of mindset and sensibilities that I wanted to have in my own poems. And those journals started, like, being receptive to my work and accepting them for publication. So I think for me, the publication part of it is kind of knowing what that journal is publishing, what their mission is, what their sensibilities are, based on who they're publishing, and sort of submitting to them. And in terms of how Phantom Tongue became a book, I had sent that to a few different presses in a few different contests, and it was a finalist at, like, a handful of them, but never quite won. And so, like, I went back and revised it over and over again, and it wasn't actually until I had written the last poem in Phantom Tongue, where it's a poem directly talking to my brother, that I ended up feeling, okay, like, this is where Phantom Tongue needs to be. And it just so happened, like, after I finished that poem and added it as a closing poem, I had sent it to Sundress Publications, and Sundress accepted it and published it, and was really great with working with me on it, giving me feedback and helping me shape it into the manuscript I really wanted it to be.
That's exciting. And so what else is happening in your world? Just to step back a little bit, you're writing. Are you also teaching? What other activities are you involved in?
Yeah, so recently, actually, in Fresno, a few other queer writers of color, Ariel Jones, Brenda Venezia, and Jamie Moore, started a queer writer of color collective, and we're trying to make sure that we can sort of help bring more queer writers of color to the attention of people in our community. For example, like, it wasn't until, like, I was probably, like, 21-ish, maybe a little bit older, that I read my first queer writer of color, And, like, I totally broke down and started crying. I was like, oh, my gosh, like, my experiences are validated now. Like, I actually, like, matter. My stories matter. And I feel like that's a really great disservice to a lot of queer people of color, especially here in the Fresno community. And so we want to start highlighting that, hey, we're writing. And if you, especially if you're a queer writer of color, like, come on. Like, we're going to do readings. We're going to do workshops. We're going to talk. We're going to get coffee. And so that's one of the things I'm doing kind of locally here in Fresno to try to help improve the community with them. And in terms of, like, other things, like stepping even further out, this summer I'm actually going to be participating in the Unamuno Poetry Festival in Madrid, where there's going to be, like, a bunch of poets that I really respect and admire there, and I'll be reading some of my work there as well, and I'm, like, really excited and nervous at the same time. and that'll be end of May this year.
And are you also teaching as well to make a living? Or other things?
Yeah, actually, funny story. I decided to take a break from academia this year. I was an adjunct lecturer, which for people who may be listening that aren't familiar with adjuncts, they're basically part-time teachers who aren't given benefits or aren't paid, like, a livable salary, essentially. And I think there's a study done recently where adjuncts are actually making equivalent to what they were making in the 80s with inflation taken into account. So that's, like, what, 30 years of stagnation? That's not sustainable. So after adjuncting for about 3 or 4 years, I realized I needed to find a job that was a little bit more stable, that wasn't leaving me every semester wondering, am I going to have a job next semester? Am I going to have a job next semester? And so I decided this last semester to leave academia and actually pursue just a full-time job, working at a retail store, actually, that ends up paying more than adjuncting did, which is says a lot that I can get a job that didn't require that master's degree and be making more money and also get benefits than I did actually teaching at a community college.
Very good. Well, congratulations on that as well. I mean, I ask because it's always important how artists, poets, writers make a living, right? That impacts what you're doing and your ability to move about, but also I would think to some degree informs a little bit of how you're writing, and it's like what your job is, whether it's in academia or not.
Absolutely.
Stephen, I want to ask you one more question that I always ask everyone. What are you reading at the moment? I'm always curious.
Yeah. So I'm actually currently rereading Adrienne Rich's collected essays on poetry. I find that revisiting, like, what she says about poetry and how she engages politics is always refreshing and kind of re-energizing to me, because it can sort of be a little easy to, like, be overwhelmed or, like, just exhausted and drained, and she sort of gives me that life back. And I highly recommend, like, reading the book is called What is Found There? Contemporary Essays on Poetry and Poetics by Adrienne Rich.
Stephen, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate your time and work.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me today.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.